If you go first and that thing jumps you, what do I do? Beverly asked. Shoot through you? If you have to, Bill said, but I suggest you try hoeing around first. Richie laughed wildly at this. We'll go through the whole place if we have to, he shrugged. Maybe we won't find anything. Do you believe that? Mike asked. No, Bill said briefly. It's here. Ben believed he was right. The house at 29 Niebold Street seemed to be encased in a poisonous envelope. It could not be seen, but it could be felt. He licked his lips. You ready? Bill asked them. They all looked back at him. Ready, Bill, Richie said. Come on, then, Bill said. Stay close behind me, Beverly. He dropped to his knees, crawled through the blighted rose bushes and under the porch. 8. They went this way. Bill, Beverly, Ben, Eddie, Richie, Stan, Mike. The leaves under the porch crackled and puffed up a sour old smell. Ben wrinkled his nose. Had he ever smelled fallen leaves like these? He thought not. And then an unpleasant idea struck him. They smelled the way he imagined a mummy would smell just after its discoverer had levered open its coffin, all dust and bitter ancient tannic acid. Bill had reached the broken cellar window and was looking into the cellar. Beverly crawled up beside him. You see anything? Bill shook his head. But that doesn't mean nothing's there. Look, there's the coal pile me and River Richie used to get out. Ben, who was looking between them, saw it. He was becoming excited as well as afraid now, and he welcomed the excitement, instinctively recognizing that it could be a tool. Seeing the coal pile was a little like seeing a great landmark about which you had only read or heard from others. Bill turned around and slipped through the window. Beverly gave Ben the bullseye, folding his hand over the cup and ball nestled in it. Give it to me the second I'm down, she said. The second? Got you. She slipped down easily and lightly. There was, for Ben at least, one heart-stopping instant when her blouse pulled out of her jeans and he saw her flat white belly. Then there was the thrill of her hands over his as he handed the slingshot down. Okay, I've got it. Come on. Ben turned around himself and began to wriggle through the window. He should have foreseen what happened next. It was really inevitable. He got stuck. His fanny bound up against the rectangular cellar window and he couldn't go in any farther. He started to pull himself out and realized, horrified, that he could do it, but was very apt to yank his pants, and perhaps his underpants as well, down to his knees when he did. And there he would be, with his extremely large ass practically in his beloved's face. Hurry up, Eddie said. Ben pushed grimly with both hands. For a moment he still couldn't move, and then his butt popped through the window hole. His blue jeans dragged painfully up into his crotch, squashing his balls. The top of the window rucked his shirt all the way up to his shoulder blades. Now his gut was stuck. Suck in, haystack, Richie said, giggling hysterically. You better suck in or we'll have to send Mike after his dad's chainfall to pull you out again. Beep, beep, Richie, Ben said through gritted teeth. He sucked his belly in as much as he could. He moved a little farther, then stopped again. He turned his head as far as he could, fighting panic and claustrophobia. His face had gone a bright, sweaty red. The sour smell of the leaves was heavy in his nostrils, cloying. Bill, can you guys pull me? He felt Bill grasp one of his ankles, Beverly the other. He sucked his belly in again, and a moment later he came tumbling through the window. Bill grabbed him. Both of them almost fell over. Ben couldn't look at Bev. He had never in his life been as embarrassed as he was at that moment. You okay, my man? Yeah. Bill laughed shakily. Beverly joined him, and then Ben was able to laugh a little, too, although it would be years before he could see anything remotely funny in what had happened. Hey, Richie called down. Eddie needs help, okay? Okay. Bill and Ben took up positions below the window. Eddie came through on his back. Bill got his legs just above the knees. Watch what you're doing, Eddie said in a querulous, nervous voice. I'm ticklish. Ramon is plenty ticklish, senhor, Richie's voice called down. Ben got Eddie around the waist, trying to keep his hand away from the cast and the sling. He and Bill manhandled Eddie through the cellar window like a corpse. Eddie cried out once, but that was all. Eddie? Yeah, Eddie said. Okay, no big deal. but large drops of sweat stood out on his forehead, and he was breathing in quick gasps. His eyes darted around the cellar. Bill stepped back again. Beverly stood near him, now holding the bullseye by the shaft and the cup, ready to fire if necessary. Her eyes swept the cellar constantly. Richie came through next, followed by Stan and Mike, all of them moving with a smooth grace that Ben deeply envied. Then they were all down, down in the cellar where Bill and Richie had seen it only a month before. The room was dim, but not dark. Dusky light shafted in through the windows and pooled on the dirt floor. The cellar seemed very big to Ben, almost too big, as if he were witnessing an optical illusion of some sort. Dusty rafters crisscrossed overhead. The furnace pipes were rusty. Some sort of dirty white cloth hung from the water pipes in dirty strings and strands. The smell was down here, too. A dirty yellow smell. Ben thought, it's here all right. Oh, yeah. Bill started toward the stairs. The others fell in behind him. He halted at their foot and glanced underneath. He reached under with one foot and kick-pawed something out. They looked at it wordlessly. It was a white clown glove, now streaked with dirt and dust. Upstairs, he said. They went up and emerged into a dirty kitchen. One plain straight-backed chair stood marooned in the center of the humped helicky linoleum. That was it for furniture. There were empty liquor bottles in one corner. Ben could see others in the pantry. He could smell booze, wine mostly, and old stale cigarettes. Those smells were dominant, but that other smell was there too. It was getting stronger all the time. Beverly went to the cupboards and opened one of them. She screamed piercingly as a blackish-brown Norway rat tumbled out almost into her face. It struck the counter with a plop and glared around at them with its black eyes. Still screaming, Beverly raised the bullseye and pulled the sling back. No, Bill roared. She turned toward him, pale and terrified. Then she nodded and relaxed her arm, the silver ball unfired. But Ben thought she had been very, very close. She backed up slowly, ran into Ben, jumped. He put an arm around her, tight. The rat scurried down the length of the counter, jumped to the floor, ran into the pantry, and was gone. It wanted me to shoot at it, Beverly said in a faint voice. Use up half of our ammunition on it. Yes, Bill said. It's little like the FBI training range at Quantico, in a wibble way. They suspend you down this Hake Street and pop up to Hargett's. If you shoot any honest citizens instead of just crooks, you lose points. I can't do this, Bill, she said. I'll mess it up. Here, you. She held the bullseye out, but Bill shook his head. You have to, Beverly. There was a mewling from another cupboard. Richie walked toward it. Don't get too close, Stan barked. It might. Richie looked inside, and an expression of sick disgust crossed his face. He slammed the cupboard shut with a bang that produced a dead echo in the empty house. A litter, Richie sounded ill. Biggest litter I ever saw. Anyone ever saw, probably. He rubbed the back of his hand across his mouth. There's hundreds of them in there. He looked at them, his mouth twitching a little on one side. Their tails. They were all tangled up, Bill, knotted together, he grimaced. Like snakes. They looked at the cupboard door. The mewling was muffled, but still audible. Rats, Ben thought, looking at Bill's white face and over Bill's shoulder at Mike's ashy gray one. Everyone's as scared of rats. It knows it, too. Come on, Bill said. Here on Nebold Street, the fun just never stops. They went down the front hall. Here the unlovely smells of rotting plaster and old urine were intermixed. They were able to look out at the street through dirty panes of glass and see their bikes. Bev's and Ben's were heeled over on their kickstands. Bill's leaned against a stunted maple tree. To Ben, the bikes looked 1,000 miles away, like things seen through the wrong end of a telescope. The deserted street with its casual patchings of asphalt, the faded, humid sky, the steady ding-ding-ding of a locomotive running on a siding, these things seemed like dreams to him, hallucinations. What was real was this squalid hallway with its stinks and shadows. There was a shatter of broken brown glass in one corner, Rheingold bottles. In the other corner, wet and swollen, was a digest-sized girly book. The woman on the cover was bent over a chair, her skirt up in the back to show the tops of her fishnet hose and her black panties. The picture did not look particularly sexy to Ben, nor did it embarrass him that Beverly had also glanced at it. Moisture had yellowed the woman's skin and humped the cover in ripples that became wrinkles on her face. Her salacious gaze had become the leer of a dead whore. Years later, as Ben recounted this, Bev suddenly cried out, startling all of them. They were not so much listening to the story as reliving it. "It was her," Bev yelled. "Mrs. Kirsch, it was her." As Ben looked, the young old crone on the girly book cover winked at him. She wiggled her fanny in an obscene come-on. Cold all over, yet sweating, Ben looked away. Bill pushed open the door on the left, and they followed him into a vault-like room that might once have been a parlor. A crumpled pair of green pants was hung over the light fixture, which depended from the ceiling. Like the cellar, this room seemed much too big to Ben, almost as long as a freight car. Much too long for a house as small as this one had appeared from the outside. "Oh, but that was outside," a new voice spoke inside his mind. It was a jocular, squealing voice, and Ben realized with sudden certainty that he was hearing Pennywise itself. Pennywise was speaking to him on some crazy metal radio. "Outside, things always look smaller than they really are, don't they, Ben?" "Go away," he whispered. Richie turned to look at him, his face still strained and pale. "You say something?" Ben shook his head. The voice was gone. That was an important thing, a good thing. Yet, outside, he had understood. This house was a special place, a kind of station, one of the places in Derry, one of the many, perhaps, from which it was able to find its way into the overworld. This stinking, rotted house where everything was somehow wrong. It wasn't just that it seemed too big. The angles were wrong, the perspective crazy. Ben was standing just inside the door between the parlor and the hallway, and the others were moving away from him across a space that now looked almost as big as Basie Park. But as they moved away, they seemed to grow larger instead of smaller. The floor seemed to slope, and Mike turned. "Ben," he called, and Ben saw alarm on his face. "Catch up, we're losing you." He could barely hear the last word. It trailed away as if the others were being swept off on a fast train. Suddenly terrified, he began to run. The door behind him swept shut with a muffled bang. He screamed, and something seemed to sweep through the air just behind him, ruffling his shirt. He looked back, but there was nothing there. That did not change his belief, however, that something had been. He caught up with the others. He was panting, out of breath, and would have sworn he had run half a mile at least. But when he looked back, the parlor's far wall was not 10 feet away. Mike grasped his shoulder hard enough to hurt. "You scared me, man," he said. Richie, Stan, and Eddie were looking at Mike questioningly. "He looked small," Mike said, "like he was a mile away." "Bill." Bill looked back. "We got to make sure everybody stays close," Ben panted. "This place, it's like the funhouse in a carnival or something. We'll get lost. I think it wants us to get lost, to get separated." Bill looked at him for a moment, lips thin. "All right," he said. "We all stay close. No stragglers." They nodded back, frightened, clustered outside the hall door. Stan's hand groped at the bird book in his back pocket. Eddie was holding his aspirator in one hand, crunching it, loosening up, then crunching it again, like a 98-pound weakling trying to build up his muscles with a tennis ball. Bill opened the door, and here was another, narrower hall. The wallpaper, which showed runners of roses and elves wearing green caps, was falling away from the spongy plaster and draggling leaves. Yellow water stains spread in senile rings on the ceiling overhead. A scummy wash of light fell through a dirty window at the end of the hall. Abruptly, the corridor seemed to elongate. The ceiling rose and then began to diminish above them like some weird rocket. The doors grew with the ceiling, pulled up like taffy. The faces of the elves grew long and became alien, their eyes bleeding black holes. Stan shrieked and clapped his hands to his eyes.
It's not real, Bill screamed.
"It is," Stan screamed back, his small closed fists plugging his eyes.
"It's real. You know it is. God, I'm going crazy. This is crazy. This is crazy."
Well,
watch.
Bill bellowed at Stan, at all of them. And Ben, his head reeling, watched as Bill bent down, coiled, and suddenly flung himself upward.
His closed left fist struck nothing, nothing at all. But there was a heavy crack sound. Plaster dust puffed from a place where there was no longer any ceiling. And then there was. The hallway was just a hallway again, narrow, low-ceilinged, dirty. But the walls no longer stretched up into forever. There was only Bill, looking at them and nursing his bleeding hand, which was floury with plaster dust. Overhead was a clear mark his fist had made in the soft plaster of the ceiling.
Not rubber real, he said to Stan, to all of them. Just a false face, like a Halloween mask.
To you, maybe, Stan said dully. His face was shocked and horrified. He looked around as if no longer sure where he was. Looking at him, smelling the sour reek coming out of his pores, Ben, who had been overjoyed at Bill's victory, got scared all over again. Stan was close to cracking up. Soon he would go into hysterics, begin to scream, perhaps, and what would happen then?
To you, Stan said again. But if I'd tried that, nothing would have happened. Because you've got your brother, Bill, but I don't have anything.
He looked around, first back toward the parlor, which had taken on a somber brown atmosphere, so thick and smoggy they could barely see the door through which they had entered it. To this hall, which was bright but somehow dark, somehow filthy, somehow utterly mad. Elves capered on the decaying wallpaper under runners of roses. Sun glared on the panes of the window at the end of the hall, and Ben knew that if they went down there, they would see dead flies, more broken glass, and then what? The floorboards spreading apart, spilling them into a dead darkness where grasping fingers waited to catch them. Stan was right. God, why had they come into its lair with nothing but their two stupid silver slugs and a fracking slingshot? He saw Stan's panic leap from one of them to the next. Like a grass fire driven by a hot wind, it widened in Eddie's eyes, dropped Bev's mouth into a wounded gasp, made Richie push his glasses up with both hands and stare around as if followed from close behind by a fiend. They trembled on the brink of flight, Bill's warning to stay together almost forgotten. They were listening to gale-force panic winds blowing between their ears. As if in a dream, Ben heard Miss Davies, the assistant librarian, reading to the little ones, "Who is that trip-trapping upon my bridge?" And he saw them, the little ones, the babies, leaning forward, their faces still and solemn, their eyes reflecting the eternal fascination of the fairy story. Would the monster be bested, or would it feed?
"I don't have anything," Stan Uris wailed, and he seemed very small, almost small enough to slip through one of the cracks in the hallway's plank flooring like a human letter. "You got your brother, man, but I don't have anything."
"You do, Bill yelled back. He grabbed Stan, and Ben felt sure he was going to bust him one, and his thoughts moaned, "No, Bill, please, that's Henry's way. If you do that, it'll kill us all right now." But Bill didn't hit Stan. He turned him around with rough hands and tore the paperback from the back pocket of Stan's jeans.
"Gimme it," Stan screamed, beginning to cry.
The others stood stunned, shrinking away from Bill, whose eyes now seemed to actually burn. His forehead glowed like a lamp, and he held the book out to Stan like a priest holding out a cross to ward off a vampire.
"You got your ber."
He turned his head up, the cords in his neck standing out, his Adam's apple like an arrowhead buried in his throat. Ben was filled with both fear and pity for his friend Bill Denbro. But there was also a strong sense of a wonderful relief. Had he doubted Bill? Had any of them?
"Oh, Bill, say it, please. Can't you say it?"
And somehow Bill did.
"You got your birds. Your birds."
He thrust the book at Stan. Stan took it and looked at Bill dumbly. Tears glimmered on his cheeks. He held the book so tightly that his fingers were white. Bill looked at him, then at the others.
"Kakahaman," he said again.
"Will the birds work?" Stan asked. His voice was low, husky. "They worked in the standpipe, didn't they?" Bev asked him. Stan looked at her uncertainly. Richie clapped him on the shoulder.
"Come on, Stan, kid," he said. "Is you a man or is you a mouse?"
"I must be a man," Stan said shakily, and wiped tears from his face with the heel of his left hand. "So far as I know, mice don't shit their pants." They laughed, and Ben could have sworn he felt the house pulling away from them from that sound. Mike turned. That big room. The one we just came through. Look. They looked. The parlor was now almost black. It was not smoke or any kind of gas. It was just blackness, a nearly solid blackness. The air had been robbed of its light. The blackness seemed to roll and flex as they stared into it, to almost coalesce into faces.
Kama'an.
They turned away from the black and walked down the hall. Three doors opened off it, two with dirty white porcelain doorknobs, the third with only a hole where the knob's shaft had been. Bill grabbed the first knob, turned it, and pushed the door open. Bev crowded up next to him, raising the bullseye. Ben drew back, aware that the others were doing the same, crowding behind Bill like frightened quail. It was a bedroom, empty save for one stained mattress. The rusty ghosts of the coils in a box spring long departed were tattooed into the mattress's yellow hide. Outside the room's one window, sunflowers dipped and nodded.
"There's nothing," Bill began,
and then the mattress began to bulge in and out rhythmically. It suddenly ripped straight down the middle. A black, sticky fluid began to spill out, staining the mattress and then running over the floor toward the doorway. It came in long, ropey tendrils.
"Shut it, Bill," Richie shouted. "Shut the fucking door."
Bill slammed it shut, looked around at them, and nodded.
"Come on."
He had barely touched the knob of the second door, this one on the other side of the narrow hall, when the buzzing scream began behind the cheap wood. 9. Even Bill drew back from that rising, inhuman cry. Ben felt the sound might drive him mad. His mind visualized a giant cricket behind the door, like something from a movie where radiation made all the bugs get big. The beginning of the end, maybe. Or the black scorpion. Or that one about the ants in the Los Angeles storm drains. He could not have run even if that buzzing rugose horror had splintered the panels of the door and begun caressing him with its great hairy legs. Beside him, he was dimly aware that Eddie was breathing in hacking gasps. The scream rose in pitch, never losing that buzzing, insectile quality. Bill fell back another step. No blood in his face now, his eyes bulging, his lips only a purple scar below his nose.
"Shoot it, Beverly,"
Ben heard himself cry. "Shoot it through the door. Shoot it before it can get us." And the sun fell through the dirty window at the end of the hall, a heavy, feverish weight. Beverly raised the bullseye like a girl in a dream as the buzzing scream rose louder, louder, louder. But before she could pull the sling back, Mike was shouting,
"No, no, don't, Bev. Oh, gosh, I'll be dipped."
And incredibly, Mike was laughing. He pushed forward, grabbed the knob, turned it, and shoved the door open. It came free of the swollen jam with a brief grinding noise.
"It's a moose blower, just a moose blower, that's all. Something to scare the crows."
The room was an empty box. Lying on the floor was a sterno can with both ends cut off. In the middle, strung tight and knotted outside holes punched in the can's sides, was a waxed length of string. Although there was no breeze in the room, the one window was shut and indifferently boarded over, letting light pass only in chinks and rays. There could be no doubt that the buzzing was coming from the can. Mike walked to it and fetched it a solid kick. The buzzing stopped as the can tumbled into a far corner.
"Just a moose blower," he said to the others, as if apologizing. "We put him on the scarecrows. It's nothing. Only a cheap trick. But I ain't a crow."
He looked at Bill, not laughing anymore, but smiling still.
"I'm still scared of it. I guess we all are. But it's scared of us, too. Tell you the truth, I think it's scared pretty bad."
Bill nodded.
I do, too," he said.
They went down to the door at the end of the hall, and as Ben watched Bill hook his finger into the hole where the doorknob shaft had been, he understood that this was where it was going to end. There would be no trick behind this door. The smell was worse now, and that thundery feeling of two opposing powers swirling around them was much stronger. He glanced at Eddie, one arm in a sling, his good hand clutching his aspirator. He looked at Bev on his other side, white-faced, holding the slingshot up like a wishbone. He thought,
"If we have to run, I'll try to protect you, Beverly. I swear I'll try."
She might have sensed his thought because she turned toward him and offered him a strained smile. Ben smiled back. Bill pulled the door open. Its hinges uttered a dull scream and then were silent. It was a bathroom. but something was wrong with it. Someone broke something in here, was all that Ben could make out at first. Not a booze bottle. What? White chips and shards, glimmering wickedly, lay strewn everywhere. Then he understood. It was the crowning insanity. He laughed. Richie joined him. Somebody must have let the granddaddy of all farts, Eddie said, and Mike began to giggle and nod his head. Stan was smiling a little. Only Bill and Beverly remained grim. The white pieces littered across the floor were shards of porcelain. The toilet bowl had exploded. The tank stood drunkenly at an angle in a puddle of water, saved from falling over by the fact that the toilet had been placed in one corner of the room and the tank had landed kitty-corner. They crowded in behind Bill and Beverly, their feet gritting on bits of porcelain. Whatever it was, Ben thought, it blew that poor toilet right to hell. He had a vision of Henry Bowers dropping two or three of his M-80s into it, slamming the lid down, then bugging out in a hurry. He couldn't think of anything else short of dynamite that would have done such a cataclysmic job. There were a few chunks, but damned few. Most of what was left were tiny, sharp slivers like blowgun darts. The wallpaper, rose runners and capering elves, as in the hall, was peppered with holes all the way around the room. It looked like shotgun blasts, but Ben knew it was more porcelain, driven into the walls by the force of the explosion. There was a bathtub standing on claw feet with generations of grimy toe jam between the blunt talons. Ben peeked into it and saw a tidal flat of silt and grit on the bottom. A rusty showerhead glared down from above. There was a basin and a medicine cabinet standing ajar above it, disclosing empty shelves. There were small rust rings on those shelves where bottles had once stood. "I wouldn't get too close to that, Big Bill," Richie said sharply, and Ben looked around. Bill was approaching the mouth of the drain hole in the floor over which the toilet had once sat. He leaned toward it and then turned back to the others.
"I can hear the pumping machinery, just like in the herons."
Bev drew closer to Bill. Ben followed her, and yes, he could hear it, that steady thrumming noise. Except, echoing up through the pipes, it didn't sound like machinery at all. It sounded like something alive.
This is where it came from, Bill said.
His face was still deadly pale, but his eyes were alight with excitement.
"This is where it came from that day, and the hat's where it always comes from. The drains.
Richie was nodding.
"We were in the cellar, but that isn't where it was. It came down the stairs, because this is where it could get out."
"And it did this?" Beverly asked.
It was in a hurry, I think, Bill said gravely.
Ben looked into the pipe. It was about 3 feet in diameter and dark as a mine shaft. The inner ceramic surface of the pipe was crusted with stuff he didn't want to know about. That thrumming sound floated up hypnotically, and suddenly he saw something. He did not see it with his physical eyes, not at first, but with one buried deep in his mind.
It was rushing toward them, moving at express train speed, filling the throat of this dark pipe from side to side. It was in its own form now, whatever that might be. It would take some shape from their minds when it got here. It was coming up from its own foul runs and black catacombs under the earth, its eyes glowing a feral yellowish green, coming. It was coming.
And then, at first like sparks, he saw its eyes down in that darkness. They took shape, flaring and malignant. Over the thrumming sound of the machinery, Ben could now hear a new noise. Woo! A fetid smell belched from the ragged mouth of the drain pipe, and he fell back, coughing and gagging.
"It's coming," he screamed. "Bill, I saw it. It's coming."
Beverly raised the bullseye.
"Good," she said.
Something exploded out of the drain pipe. Ben, trying to recall that first confrontation later, could only remember a silvery, orange, shifting shape. It was not ghostly, it was solid, and he sensed some other shape, some real and ultimate shape, behind it. But his eyes could not grasp what he was seeing, not precisely. Then Richie was stumbling backward, his face a scrawl of terror, screaming over and over again,
"The werewolf, Bill! It's the werewolf! The teenage werewolf!"
And suddenly the shape locked into reality. For Ben, for all of them.
The werewolf stood poised over the drainpipe, one hairy foot on either side of where the toilet had once been. Its green eyes glared at them from its feral face. Its muzzle wrinkled back and yellowish-white foam seeped through its teeth. It uttered a shattering growl, its arms pistoned out toward Beverly, the cuffs of its high school letter jacket pulling back from its fur-covered arms. Its smell was hot and raw and murderous. Beverly screamed. Ben grabbed the back of her blouse and yanked so hard that the seams under the arms tore. One clawed hand swept through the air where she had been only a moment before. Beverly went stumbling backward against the wall. The silver ball popped out of the cup of the bullseye. For a moment, it glimmered in the air. Mike, quicker than quick, snatched it and gave it back to her.
"Shoot it, baby," he said. His voice was perfectly calm, almost serene. "You shoot it right now."
The werewolf uttered a shattering roar that became a flesh-freezing howl. Its snout turned up toward the ceiling. The howl became a laugh. It lunged at Bill as Bill turned to look at Beverly. Ben shoved him aside, and Bill went sprawling.
"Shoot it, Bev," Richie screamed. "For God's sake, shoot it."
The werewolf sprang forward, and there was no question in Ben's mind, then or later, that it knew exactly who was in charge here. Bill was the one it was after. Beverly drew and fired. The ball flew, and again it was off the mark, but this time there was no saving curve. It missed by more than a foot, punching a hole in the wallpaper above the tub. Bill, his arms peppered with bits of porcelain and bleeding in a dozen places, uttered a screaming curse. The werewolf's head snapped around. Its gleaming green eyes considered Beverly. Not thinking, Ben stepped in front of her as she groped in her pocket for the other silver slug. The jeans she wore were too tight. She had donned them with no thought of provocation. It was just that, as with the shorts she had worn on the day of Patrick Hochstetter and the refrigerator, she was still wearing last year's model. Her fingers closed on the ball, but it squirted away. She groped again and got it. She pulled it, turning her pocket inside out and spilling 14 cents, the stubs of two Aladdin tickets, and a quantity of pocket lint onto the floor. The werewolf lunged at Ben, who was standing protectively in front of her and blocking her field of fire. Its head was cocked at the predator's deadly questing angle, its jaws snapping. Ben reached blindly for it. There seemed to be no room in his reactions now for terror. He felt a clear-headed sort of anger instead, mixed with bewilderment, and a sense that somehow time had come to a sudden, unexpected screech halt. He snagged his hands in tough, matted hair. "The pelt," he thought. "I've got its pelt." And he could feel the heavy bone of its skull beneath. He thrust at that wolfish head with all of his force, but although he was a big boy, it did no good at all. If he had not stumbled back and struck the wall, the thing would have torn his throat open with its teeth. It came after him, its greenish-yellow eyes flaring, growling with each breath. It smelled of the sewer and something else, some wild yet unpleasant odor like rotten hazelnuts. One of its heavy paws rose, and Ben skittered aside as best he could. The paw, tipped with heavy claws, ripped bloodless wounds through the wallpaper and into the cheesy plaster beneath. He could dimly hear Richie bellowing something, Eddie howling at Beverly to shoot it, but Beverly did not. This was her only other chance. That didn't matter. She intended that it be the only one she would need. A clear coldness she never saw again in her life fell over her sight. In it, everything stood out and forward. Never again would she see the three dimensions of reality so clearly defined. She possessed every color, every angle, every distance. Fear departed. She felt the hunter's simple lust of certainty and oncoming consummation. Her pulse slowed. The hysterical, trembling grip in which she had been holding the bullseye loosened, then firmed and became natural. She drew in a deep breath. It seemed to her that her lungs would never fill completely. Dimly, faintly, she heard popping sounds. Didn't matter, whatever they were. She tracked left, waiting for the werewolf's improbable head to fall with cool perfection into the wishbone beyond the extended V of the drawn-back sling. The werewolf's claws descended again. Ben tried to duck under them, but suddenly he was in its grip. It jerked him forward as if he had been no more than a rag doll. Its jaws snapped open.
"Bastard!"
He thrust a thumb into one of its eyes. It bellowed with pain, and one of those claw-tipped paws ripped through his shirt. Ben sucked his stomach in, but one of the claws pulled a sizzling line of pain down his torso. Blood gushed out of him and splattered on his pants, his sneakers, the floor. The werewolf threw him into the bathtub. He thumped his head, saw stars, struggled into a sitting position, and saw his lap was full of blood. The werewolf whirled around.
Ben observed with that same lunatic clarity that it was wearing faded Levi Strauss blue jeans. The seams had split open. A snot-cake red bandana, the sort a train man might carry, hung from one back pocket. Written on the back of its black and orange high school jacket were the words, Derry High School Killing Team. Below this, the name Pennywise. And in the center, a number, 13. It went for Bill again. He had gotten to his feet and now stood with his back to the wall, looking at it steadily.
Shoot it, Beverly,
Richie screamed again. Beep, beep, Richie, she heard herself reply from roughly 1,000 miles away. The werewolf's head was suddenly there, in the wishbone. She covered one of its green eyes with the cup and released. There was no shake in either of her hands. She fired as smoothly and naturally as she had fired at the cans in the dump on the day they had all taken turns to see who was the best. There was time for Ben to think, Oh, Beverly, if you miss this time, we're all dead, and I don't want to die in this dirty bathtub, but I can't get out. There was no miss. A round eye, not green, but dead black, suddenly appeared high up in the center of its snout. She had aimed for the right eye and missed by less than half an inch. Its scream, an almost human scream of surprise, pain, fear, and rage, was deafening. Ben's ears rang with it. Then the perfect round hole in its snout was gone, obscured by freshets of blood. It was not flowing. It gouted from the wound in a high-pressure torrent. The freshet drenched Bill's face and hair. Doesn't matter, Ben thought hysterically. Don't worry, Bill. Nobody will be able to see it anyway when we get out of here, if we ever do. Bill and Beverly advanced on the werewolf, and behind them, Richie cried out hysterically, Shoot it again, Beverly. Kill it.
Kill it, Mike screamed.
That's right, kill it, Eddie chimed in.
Kill it,
Bill cried, his mouth drawn down in a quivering bow. There was a whitish-yellow streak of plaster dust in his hair.
Kill it, Beverly. Don't let it get away.
No ammo left, Ben thought incoherently. We're slugged out. What are you talking about? Kill it. But he looked at Beverly and understood. If his heart had never been hers before that moment, it would have flown to her then. She had pulled the sling back again. Her fingers were closed over the cup, hiding its emptiness.
Kill it,
Ben screamed, and flopped clumsily over the edge of the tub. His jeans and underwear were soaked against his skin with blood. He had no idea if he was hurt badly or not. Following the original hot sizzle, there hadn't been much pain, but there sure was an awful lot of blood. The werewolf's greenish eyes flickered among them, now filled with uncertainty as well as pain. Blood poured down the front of its jacket in sheets. Bill Denbrough smiled. It was a gentle, rather lovely smile, but it did not touch his eyes. You shouldn't have started with my brother, he said. Send the fucker to hell, Beverly. The uncertainty left the creature's eyes. It believed. With lithe, smooth grace, it turned and dived into the drain. As it went, it changed. The Derry High jacket melted into its pelt, and the color ran out of both. The shape of its skull elongated, as if it had been made of wax, which was now softening and beginning to run. Its shape changed. For one instant, Ben believed he had nearly seen what shape it really was, and his heart froze inside his chest, leaving him gasping.
I'll kill you all,
a voice roared from inside the drain pipe. It was thick, savage, not in the least human.
Kill you all, kill you all, kill you all.
The words faded back and back, diminishing, washing out, growing distant. At last, joining the low, throbbing hum of the pumping machinery floating through the pipes. The house seemed to settle with a heavy, sub-audible thud. But it wasn't settling, Ben realized. In some strange way, it was shrinking, coming back to its normal size. Whatever magic it had used to make the house at 29 Niebold Street seem bigger was now withdrawn. The house snapped back like an elastic. It was only a house now, smelling damp and a little rotten, an unfurnished house where winos and hobos sometimes came to drink and talk and sleep out of the rain. It was gone. In its wake, the silence seemed very loud. 10.
We got to get out of this place,
Bill said. He walked over to where Ben was trying to get up and grabbed one of his outstretched hands. Beverly was standing near the drain.
She looked down at herself, and that coldness disappeared in a flush that seemed to turn all her skin into one warm stocking. It must have been a deep breath indeed. The dim popping sounds had been the buttons on her blouse. They were gone, every single one of them. The blouse hung open, and her small breasts were clearly revealed. She snatched the blouse closed.
Richie, Bill said. Help me with Ben. He's
Richie joined him, then Stan and Mike. The four of them got Ben to his feet. Eddie had gone to Beverly and put his good arm awkwardly around her shoulders.
You did great, he said.
And Beverly burst into tears. Ben took two big staggering steps to the wall and leaned against it before he could fall over again. His head felt light. Color kept washing in and out of the world. He felt decidedly pukey. Then Bill's arm was around him, strong and comforting.
How bad is it, Haystack?
Ben forced himself to look down at his stomach. He found performing two simple actions, bending his neck and spreading apart the slit in his shirt, took more courage than he had needed to enter the house in the first place. He expected to see half his insides hanging down in front of him like grotesque udders. Instead, he saw that the flow of blood had slowed to a sluggish trickle. The werewolf had slashed him long and deep, but apparently not mortally. Richie joined them. He looked at the cut, which ran a twisting course down Ben's chest, and petered out on the upper bulge of his stomach, then soberly into Ben's face.
It just about had your guts for suspenders, Haystack. You know it?
No fake, Jake, Ben said.
He and Richie stared at each other for a long, considering moment, and then they broke into hysterical giggles at the same instant, spraying each other with spittle. Richie took Ben into his arms and pounded his back.
We beat it, Haystack. We beat it.
Well, we didn't beat it, Bill said grimly. We got a little lucky. Let's get out before it decides to come back.
Where?
Mike asked.
The Barrens, Bill said.
Beverly made her way over to them, still holding her blouse closed. Her cheeks were bright red.
The clubhouse?
Bill nodded.
Can I have someone's shirt?
Beverly asked, blushing more furiously than ever. Bill glanced down at her, and the blood came into his own face, all in a rush. He turned his eyes away hastily, but in that instant Ben felt a rush of knowledge and dismal jealousy. In that instant, that one bare second, Bill had become aware of her in a way that only Ben himself had been before. The others had also looked and then turned away. Richie coughed against the back of his hand, Stan turned red, and Mike Hanlon dropped back a step or two as if actually frightened by the side swell of that one small white breast visible below her hand. Beverly threw her head up, shaking her tangled hair back behind her. She was still blushing, but her face was lovely.
I can't help it that I'm a girl, she said, or that I'm starting to get big on top. Now can't I please have someone's shirt?
Sure, Bill said.
He pulled his white T-shirt over his head, baring his narrow chest, the visible rack of his ribs, his sunburned, freckled shoulders.
Here.
Thank you, Bill, she said. And for one hot, smoking moment, their eyes locked directly. Bill did not look away this time. His gaze was firm, adult.
Welcome, he said. Good luck, Big Bill, Ben thought,
and he turned away from that gaze.